You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Atlas Shrugged by Dirk Smillie. Was Minard's impulse to control people in his off-hours compensation for the lack of control he felt in his own workplace? His industry peers, PIMCO's Bill Gross, Bridgewater's Ray Dalio, Double Line's Jeff Gundlach, had enormous influence over the firms they helped build. Minard never had that kind of power at Guggenheim. He was reminded of this when he reportedly lost an epic battle with CEO Mark Walter in 2016. A confidant of Walter's was promoted to global head of the institutional distribution team, reportedly not Minard's first choice. She then restructured the U.S. distribution team, axing 22 staffers. Minard was furious. Rumors spread that he would quit. He stayed, but moments like these must have left him with a sense of being diminished by peers inside Guggenheim. During Minard's most successful years, the firm's management committee consisted of then-president Todd Boehly, Walter, executive chairman Alan Schwartz, and Minard. Boehly was off building a small media empire, acquiring Billboard, The Hollywood Reporter, and Dick Clark Productions, producer of the Golden Globes. Schwartz had famously scored a stunning coup, landing Guggenheim a key advisory role on the $130 billion Verizon Vodafone buyout, one of the biggest deals in global corporate history. Walter organized a Guggenheim investor group with Magic Johnson and others to buy the Dodgers for $2.15 billion, more than doubling in value since. Minard had his own projects, as they were called internally, like the LeBron James deal, but nothing like these. He could have co-invested with Walter and Boehly in the Dodgers acquisition, but declined. A decision one friend said Minard likely regretted. Minard was a soft-spoken, sensitive guy, known for his rapid ascent to power on Wall Street, but who didn't fit in with the alpha-aggressive culture at most Wall Street firms. Boehly, Schwartz, and Walter had traditional families with children. Minard was a gay bodybuilder with no kids, who married a man nearly 20 years his junior. "I'm clearly the stepchild of the leadership team," he once joked to me. Even his musical taste made him an outlier. Guggenheim's Chicago office holiday parties would host cocktail singers like James Bulanda. In Minard's Santa Monica office, the playlist for parties would include singers from The Cult or Jane's Addiction. He was a devotee of the late Chris Cornell, and friendly with electronic dance music artist Steve Aoki. He was a die-hard Linkin Park fan. When the band's lead singer, Chester Bennington, died by suicide, Minard attended the funeral. In Minard's last few years, he favored gingham shirts and purple ties. Often his complexion was pallid, eyelids slightly drooping and rapidly blinking, his slightly oversized lower lip giving him the appearance of a pouty man-boy. At one point, he embraced a new look, sporting Moschino-style tortoiseshell glasses and a ginger dye job. "Who is that? Elton John?" cracked a colleague, watching Minard on CNBC. But just a few months before his death, he appeared to gain weight, looking more obese than muscular. His gravelly, halting voice made him sound like a man whose tie was too tight. He sometimes appeared unhealthy, and he was. Menard suffered from scoliosis, heart disease, high cholesterol, and a red blood cell disorder requiring regular treatment, according to friends, his death certificate, and court filings. There was a consolation prize for Menard's stepchild status at Guggenheim. The rise of Scott Menard, Wall Street influencer. Boley, Schwartz, and Walter believed in staying off the media radar screen, prompting reporters to call Guggenheim mysterious. When one member of top leadership granted a rare in-depth interview, a leading public relations guru was flown in to coach the executive for a five-figure fee. Menard was a cost-effective talking head, requiring no media coaching and relatively little prep. He could answer a question about European monetary policy in plain English. Never in the history of the world have we had a series of central banks essentially propping up global economies by printing money, he told Consuelo Mack on WealthTrack. He was a Republican, but a centrist. Scott was politically commonsensical, said Luntz. He was focused on results and solutions. 2 years before he died, in a chat with editorial staffers at the Los Angeles Times, Menard backed Medicare for All and said the Green New Deal is actually not such a bad idea. Menard became the face of Guggenheim, a role he jealously guarded. Media interviews were his emotional counterprogramming. They seemed to make him feel better, like a good therapy session. When he was on set, spouting his opinions about 10-year Treasury yields, he felt acceptance and affirmation. Conversations with TV anchors revolved around his opinions, his predictions. He once received a call from Sylvester Stallone seeking life insurance advice during an on-air interview, dazzling his host, Bloomberg News' John Gittleson. One problem: the hot take culture of business media isn't a great match for a think slow investment approach. He flip-flopped on Bitcoin, stating it should be worth $400,000, then that it could fall to $15,000, causing a hellish backlash from crypto fans. A year before his death, he predicted there could be a recession 2 to 3 years out. Nope. He insisted gold could reach $5,000 per ounce. It has yet to clear $3,000. Next photo, the monument. Menard's final resting place, a hand-carved white marble sarcophagus, the size of a minivan, shocked some of his friends. Growing up, Menard spent a lot of time in church. A solo vocalist in the choir, he read from scripture at Good Friday services. He was raised in Chalk Hill, Pennsylvania, a tiny mountain community, population 71. His interest in bodybuilding was furthered by a summer job laying railroad tracks. It helped transform him from a skinny teen to a muscle-bound youth. Kendall Menard, his father, was an insurance agent and worked for a railroad. His mother, Carol, was a rock-ribbed Presbyterian and, according to friends, a devout alcoholic. She imbued in him a sense of fear and respect for his faith. But as he got older and tried to come to terms with his sexuality, he received no understanding, much less acceptance, from his mother, said a friend. There weren't many gay cultural icons in the 1970s and 80s, certainly not in the Rust Belt. Growing up gay in Pennsylvania coal country would have put crushing weight on his self-image. Graduating from Wharton in 1980, Menard became an accountant at a Big Four firm. Soon, however, he changed career course, going to work in capital markets at Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley. The the wild number of variables affecting fixed income investing, credit quality, fiscal policies, currency movements, fascinated him. Soon, he was executing complicated trades around Swedish bonds, then a deal involving debt restructuring for Italy. From there, he went to Credit Suisse First Boston, running the fixed income desk. Some 15 years after he'd started, he had made enough to retire, or so he thought. At age 37, he moved to a waterfront home in L.A.'s Venice to devote time to bodybuilding. Gold's Gym, the powerlifting center of the universe, became his second home. There he met Figueroa, a personal trainer who became his best friend. Figueroa was a minor celebrity with a major following in the bodybuilding world. He says he treated Menard's scoliosis with physical therapy 3 times a week and oversaw the design of his home gym. Menard competed in L.A. bodybuilding championships, once ranking 8th in the super heavyweight division. At his peak, he could bench press 495 pounds for 20 straight repetitions. He and Figueroa ate often at the Firehouse on Rose Avenue, a former fire station converted to a restaurant catering to the Muscle Beach crowd. Among Menard's favorite orders, the Hefty Bob Bowl from the bodybuilder's menu, loaded with Angus steak, peppers, and rice. In a 2012 interview, he recalled bumping into fellow bodybuilder and former governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. "He's smaller than me now," Menard marveled. In 1998, Walter, a former client, made Menard an offer to join a company he was forming. The new firm united 3 entities, Walter's Chicago Commercial Paper Company, a broker-dealer in New York, and some real estate assets owned by the Guggenheim family, under a single brand, Guggenheim Partners. Menard said he'd join if he could stay in California. The firm grew, and so did his visibility. In Menard's early years at Guggenheim, Bloomberg Television rolled out a number of new shows. Fox Business launched, as did CNBC's Closing Bell. They were new platforms hungry for talent. As he gained visibility and wealth, the public Menard assumed the trappings of an aristocrat. He bought homes with vineyards, stables, and golf courses, but had no interest in wine or horses, and didn't play golf. Early in his Wall Street career, Menard felt his peers would not accept him as a gay man, said Figueroa. Over time, Menard also struggled to reconcile his devout upbringing. He was known to pray in the morning and at night. Once he spent hours flipping through the pages of a Bible, looking for references to homosexuality to understand God's will on the matter, said a friend. Around the time his mother died in 2013, Menard began dating Mendez, whom Menard had met years earlier when Mendez was waiting tables at the Firehouse. He was nearly 20 years younger than Menard, charismatic, with a broad movie star smile. Restaurant work was his day job. Mendez had acting credits and had begun serving as a producer on short films. Mendez did not respond to an interview request or to specific questions sent for this story. Menard was smitten by the young man, originally from rural Oaxaca. Mendez's father was a corn farmer. His mother sold flowers at a local market. Watching telenovelas as a kid, he dreamed of becoming an actor. He came to California at 18, settling in Venice Beach, taking ESL classes at night. One evening, his mostly Hispanic class performed West Side Story in English. When people clapped at his performance, he once said on a podcast, "I have never in my life felt so alive." Mendez enrolled in acting classes in Anaheim, taking 6 buses and traveling for 4 hours twice a week, he said. He created a fake resume and began submitting himself for roles, making his movie debut in an independent film Bread and Roses, starring Adrian Brody. Mendez and Minard traveled everywhere together, the Golden Globes, Sundance, the Super Bowl. When Mendez and Minard joined Ethel Kennedy for a personal lunch, Mendez once recalled, "She fell in love with me. We talked about immigration, migrant workers, Cesar Chavez." Minard at least once described Mendez as his personal assistant. Minard's courtship occasionally involved outlandish gifts. He once arranged for Sharon Stone to record a message on Mendez's mobile phone. Another friend, the financier Henry Silverman, advised Minard, "Just marry him," according to a pal. Finally, Minard followed that advice. The couple were wed in 2017 in a Las Vegas ceremony officiated by Wayne Newton. In Mendez, described by a friend as a nurturer, Minard got the adoration and acceptance he craved. According to her court filings, Chiota befriended Minard in 2008 through her boyfriend, an executive at Guggenheim Partners. At the time, she was a 30-something Venice resident who had studied veterinary technology in college and ran a popular pet care business in Santa Monica. Her wide-set blue eyes and mane of beach hair convey the look of an archetypal California girl fresh from the waves. A year later, he adopted Gracie, a small one-year-old rescue dog, a Shiba Inu Labrador mix. He was quickly obsessed. A friend recalls Minard rolling around Chiota's lawn, playing endlessly with Gracie until his pants nearly came down trying to grab her. As Gracie got older, Scotty got younger, a friend says. Gracie gave Scott the unconditional love he never got from his parents. Court documents filed by Chiota's lawyers contend that Minard suggested a shared custody arrangement of Gracie. He wanted Chiota to care for the dog in his absence and bring Gracie to his home or office on a moment's notice, day or night. In exchange for this, Minard would buy a house for Chiota to live in at a location halfway between his home and his Guggenheim office. She found such a place, a 1940s one-story white stucco home in Venice. Minard bought it for $1.1 million, paid the carrying cost, and drew up a sham lease for tax purposes, according to her filing. Chiota maintained the property and paid utilities. She has lived in the house rent-free for a decade. Her court documents claim that Minard told her the title of the house would be transferred to her upon his death. The estate's attorneys contended that she was technically a renter. The Venice home is held in a limited liability company Minard created. His castle in California was held by Chateau de Gracie, LLC. When his marriage to Mendez hit bumps, apparently over the lack of effort Minard seemed to be putting into their relationship, says a friend, Minard broke down crying. Had they broken up, Mendez would not have been destitute. According to a friend, their prenuptial agreement called for Mendez to receive a hefty settlement. But Mendez didn't want to leave Minard. He wanted their marriage to succeed. Chiota intervened, telling Minard to take Mendez on a proper date, not to a business event. The couple reconciled, as Minard came to trust Chiota on other personal matters. As Gracie aged, Minard asked Chiota to arrange for the dog to be cloned, a court document says. He swore her to secrecy. Pet cloning is a wildly contentious issue in California and elsewhere. So Chiota made the deposit for the $50,000 procedure, using transferred funds on Minard's behalf just before his death. Gracie, apparently, was never copied. In June 2021, a court filing of Figueroa's says Minard mentioned the 24/7 business arrangement he had with Chiota. He now wanted the same with Figueroa. In return for catering to Minard's needs around the clock and giving up his other clients and business, he would pay Figueroa $160,000 annually and buy a $4.2 million home in nearby Carlsbad for him to live in. In that filing, Figueroa claimed that if he agreed, Minard promised to bequeath the home to him in his will. A second home south of Yosemite would also be part of the deal. What does Minard's will say about the claims of his two friends? Not a thing. There is no mention of the homes Chiota and Figueroa says they were promised. Instead, they separately faced eviction. In a court document, Chiota's lawyers say she suspects the will may not be authentic. The estate's legal team includes super lawyer Eric V. Rowan, who repped Britney Spears in her conservator fight and scored a winning verdict for Katy Perry in a real estate dispute. In an early filing, the lawyer suggested that if Chiota's tactics continued, she could be an extortionist, slowing administration of the estate with court filings to extract a settlement. The fact that the will was filed in Nevada has largely kept it off the media's radar. Attorneys for the estate redacted the will in public filings, blocking out beneficiaries. And what percentage of the estate they'll receive, even redacting the reference to who gets Gracie. In a declaration, a lawyer in the case contends this is necessary given the highly sensitive and private nature of Mr. Minard's estate. The question remains as to why a man worth $400 million seems to have prepared a will just 6 pages long, filled with typos. This seeming lack of attention to executing the will doesn't worry Tasha K. Dickinson, senior partner at Day Pitney in West Palm Beach, Florida, which handles high net worth estate planning. Scott Minard's will may have been a band-aid while he contemplated a more robust estate plan, she says. No one plans to die at 63. There are no affidavits accompanying the two witnesses who signed the will, though not necessarily required, and there are no printed names below their signatures, which are illegible. The will was executed in Los Angeles County, but a source confirmed to Vanity Fair that Minard appears to have been in Rancho Santa Fe in San Diego County that day. A filing from the estate offers a potentially simple explanation for some of these oddities. Minard himself drafted the will. The attorneys have worked to administer the estate as privately as possible, asking that beneficiaries sign forms, agreeing not to require an inventory of the estate, and requesting court permission, later given, to sell an unnamed artwork of Minard's to a secret buyer for an undisclosed price. Neither Fedoris nor attorneys for the estate have responded to requests for comment. Minard's eclectic taste were reflected by his possessions. He was said to keep in his safe at the big house a multi-platinum record, Meteora, by Linkin Park, signed by band members. On a wall behind a door at another house was an original oil portrait of George Washington. In a closet, a cast of the life mask of Abraham Lincoln. There is also Minard's collection of Charles Schulz art. He possessed several hundred pieces of the illustrator's work. His collection was so large that a 3-week exhibition of it appeared at Laguna College of Art and Design, including some of the most valuable storyboards and animation cells from Peanuts holiday specials. In September, a Los Angeles court denied Chioda's request to open a second or ancillary probate and to be named administrator of the estate. But she's continuing her fight in the courts, as is Figueroa. The estate has attempted to evict Alex from the homes he claims Scott intended to give him, says his attorney, Edmund E. Salem. We'll be challenging the Nevada court's jurisdiction over Scott's assets in California. Minard had a dream one night, says another longtime friend, the Reverend Andy Bales, the former president and chief executive of Union Rescue Mission in L.A., the city's oldest mission and homeless shelter. He told Bales He dreamed about the homeless women and children he had met on a recent visit to the nonprofit's transitional housing facility. Suddenly, they were not at the shelter, but in homes with beautiful sweeping gardens bordered by white picket fences. A short time later, Menard arranged to donate a 700-acre ranch he owned to the mission to be used as transitional housing. After another visit to the mission, when it was grappling with the need to close a facility for single mothers and their kids, he wrote a personal check for $212,000 on the spot. In little over a decade, Menard donated a total of $27 million to the mission, says Bales. He was the most generous human I've ever met. The Union Rescue Mission is about to get a few more million dollars. Vanity Fair has obtained an unredacted copy of Menard's will, revealing that the organization is the single largest beneficiary of his residuary estate, accorded 34% of it. This would place it among the largest bequest to a homeless organization in U.S. history. Mendez will receive $30 million in cash and assets, plus 15% of the residuary estate. He has also bequeathed ownership of Gracie. Several Christian-related charities, along with Fedoris and Menard's nephew, Matthew Menard, will get 5% apiece. Three other individuals, including a bodybuilding friend in England, Jason Crow, will each get 1% of the estate, according to the unredacted will, once everything is settled. Beyond philanthropy, Menard had plans for preserving the resource-rich Arctic. Over the course of a decade, he helped spearhead a protocol respecting the rights of native Arctic peoples and aided the creation of a $1 trillion inventory of required infrastructure. 2 months before his death, he announced plans for a think tank to advance these goals, the Menard Institution for Arctic Peace and Prosperity. Those plans apparently died with him. His charity interest brought together the public and private Scott Menard. Near the end of his life, he seemed to feel greater acceptance and purpose in giving money away than making it. He worked with an NGO to create housing for LGBTI plus citizens in Uganda. As a board member at Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, he aided a program helping achieve U.S. protective status for Haitian and Cameroonian refugees. In life, as he once said in an interview, everybody cries out for understanding, but when you turn it around and you talk to people, at their core, what they really want is to be accepted. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Ben Stiller, the Severance director, and not-so-secret Trekkie, on Spock ears, becoming a triple threat, and the torment of being a Knicks fan. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I wish I was shorter. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being in process on a creative project I love. What is your most treasured possession? The Spock ears that Leonard Nimoy gave to me. How would you like to die? Quickly. Which living person do you most admire? Filippo Grandi, United Nations Refugee Agency High Commissioner. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Self-doubt. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Self-importance. What is your greatest extravagance? My Star Trek memorabilia. What is your favorite journey? A road trip through the Northeast in the fall. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Practicality. On what occasion do you lie when I'm trying not to hurt someone's feelings? What do you dislike most about your appearance? Don't get me started. Which living person do you most despise? That guy. What is your greatest fear? Losing my mind. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Like, you know, What is your greatest regret? Letting the past affect my enjoyment of the present many times over the years. When and where were you happiest? Probably as a small child in a pool in my mother's arms. Which talent would you most like to have? The ability to sing and dance well. What is your current state of mind, present and hopeful? What do you consider your greatest achievement? Recognizing what I have and appreciating it. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? William Shatner. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? Mitch McConnell's conscience. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? The 2014-15 Knicks. Where would you like to live? In a world without social media. What is your favorite occupation? Making a movie. What is your most marked characteristic? Durability. What do you most value in your friends? Honesty and unconditional love. Who are your favorite writers? George Saunders, Kurt Vonnegut, Salinger, Maurice Sendak, Jerry Stahl. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Jean Valjean. Who are your heroes in real life? MLK, Paul Farmer, Navalny, my father. What are your favorite names? Ebenezer, Andrikus, Elvis, Carlo, Rex, Emily, Sarah, Gwendolyn. What is it that you most dislike? Pain. What is your motto? Not YOLO. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Ben Stiller. suspicious minds, true crime enthusiasts, are exactly what the name suggests. Rubberneckers in it for the gore, or prurience, or ick, some kind of thrill. But the attendees of CrimeCon suggest something a little deeper and scarier than any of that. By Kathleen Hale, with illustrations by Ivan Gillow. On the weekend of September 22, 2023, 4,000 women, and some men too, descended on the Orlando World Center Marriott for the 6th annual CrimeCon. Described by its founder, Kevin Balfe, as a place where victims can feel loved. Launched in 2017, CrimeCon brings together consumers and content creators within the true crime genre for presentations by criminology experts, law enforcement, victims, and niche celebrities, such as renowned pedophile catcher Chris Hansen. The convention's attendance pales beside events like GamesCon, around 320,000 participants, and comic conventions, more than 126,000 at L.A. Comic-Con alone, but distinguishes itself by its overwhelmingly female spectatorship. Balfe estimates that 80% of his attendees are women. CrimeCon Orlando kicked off in the Grand Ballroom with a neon-themed rock concert by The Sole Purpose, featuring guitarist Creighton Waters, otherwise known as the prosecuting attorney in the Alex Murdoch trial. The band played covers of Peaceful Easy Feeling by the Eagles and Whiskey Glasses by Morgan Wallen, while in a roped-off VIP area, women posed in police caps and other props at a complimentary photo booth. Nearby, two adult sisters danced with their elderly mother, who had warned them since birth about bad men. And perhaps that's why they were here tonight, still alive. Later, the dance floor and cocktail tables would be replaced by enough chairs to accommodate thousands more true crime fans. But for now, LED glasses and headbands shaped by Playboy bunny ears flashed in the dark as women in sequins and feather boas shimmered to a bracing cover of Shamalama Ding Dong. "We literally marinate in true crime all day," shouted an Orlando-based massage therapist, raising her voice to be heard over I'm Every Woman. She and a longtime client had embarked on a girls' trip to CrimeCon and fondly recalled how they'd been talking about murder since their very first bodywork session. "We bonded from that." Over the intervening years, the two had started playing true crime podcasts and documentaries during massages. Now they described themselves as best friends in true crime. "Excuse me," intoned a low voice, and I looked up to see a bearded man wielding a beanbag. Apparently, I was blocking his neon cornhole game, an actual thing that was happening. Because, yes, there were men at CrimeCon, though my conversations with them gave the impression that they'd come here under duress. One described his female companion's true crime obsession as very weird. Another would find himself so nauseated by the weekend's proceedings that he left the conference while his wife stayed behind, riveted and unburdened. Even CrimeCon speaker Paul Holes, the handsome former investigator, famous for his role in catching the Golden State Killer, now a niche celebrity among true crime junkies who lust after the troubled male detective archetype, had, in a certain way, come at the behest of women. He, too, would feel overwhelmed that weekend, not just by traumatic memories of old cases, which simmer to the surface during his CrimeCon presentations, necessitating a CrimeCon-branded mug of bourbon, which Holes carried with him on stage, or during the simple and necessary act of sleep, necessitating more bourbon. Blacking out was a respite from the nightmares, including a recurring one of a victim's face, caved in and hatching flies, but also by the masses of women who hindered his movements and touched him during selfies. When asked, "What brought you here?" One man at the Soul Purpose concert, Shane, in his 50s, answered plainly, "My wife." He and Tammy, couple's name, Shammy, they told me twice, were discussing the gender disparity at CrimeCon when I arrived at their table. Shane attributed it to commercials. He said, presumably alluding to the Activia ads, or whatever, that air between segments of Dateline. When asked what she thought, Tammy hesitated, as if trying to formulate a response that would not discredit Shane's. Finally, she ventured, quietly, with evident self-doubt, as if not wanting to offend her husband, "Well, I wonder if it's because a lot of the victims are women." As if on cue, two beautiful survivors of domestic violence, Natalia, 38, and Stacy, 43, danced through the ballroom's doorway in matching tie-dyed overalls. Like many other women that evening, they were twinning. Natalia and Stacy had connected 15 years earlier while living in Colorado, after Stacy spotted Natalia trudging through their shared apartment complex with a bottle of wine in each hand and quickly identified her as a kindred spirit. Later, during a blizzard, they watched the entire Casey Anthony trial together on Stacy's laptop while sorting jelly beans into personalized piles. Stacy loved red, Natalia preferred green, and they both liked blue, which they stacked in the middle. "Barbie," Natalia exclaimed, admiring a woman dressed like the doll. Stacy promised me that Natalia had strong opinions about ongoing cases. Both women believe that Brian Koberger, the former criminology student charged with murdering four college kids at the University of Idaho in 2022, is definitely guilty. In part, because of the evidence against him, but also because, well, he just looked like one of those guys women instinctively avoid. "We have to deal with creeps 24/7, Natalia said, "even when we're children." After the concert ended, I returned to my hotel around 1 a.m. Heading to the elevators, I overheard newlyweds Kirsten, 31, and Molly, 32, debating the death penalty in the lobby. "The only way that it should be okay is in a lethal injection situation," argued Kirsten, a nanny with pink-streaked hair. "That's kind of moral. We do that to our dogs, you know what I mean?" Molly, a deadpan attorney, turned to me. "On the record, our dogs are alive." Kirsten rolled her eyes. "No, I'm just saying, when they're old. We have two basset hounds. We love them. They're alive," Molly reiterated. Both were CrimeCon diehards, honeymooning at this year's convention after getting engaged at the previous one in Vegas. There, Molly had taken Kirsten to the Shark Reef Aquarium at Mandalay Bay, where a scuba diver swam over and pressed to the exhibit glass a laminated printout bearing clip art of two dolphins kissing and the proposal, "Kirsten, will you marry me?" As animal lovers, both wanted to wed at a zoo, but back home in Tennessee, the two ended up getting emergency married, as Kirsten put it, after Governor Bill Lee signed anti-drag legislation into law, which was later overturned. "It could be scary living down south," Molly conceded. She'd once been chased from a mall by a man screaming, "Faggots!" Upon reflection, Molly granted that being gay in America had scaffolded at least some of her interest in true crime, attributing the relatability of victimization to why a lot of women in general gravitate toward the genre. "It could happen to you, so you have to be aware and vigilant," she explained, describing the urge to study criminal cases as a means of self-defense. Information is knowledge. For her part, Kirsten traced her own obsession with crime to the fact that her childhood babysitter had been murdered violently, kidnapped, tortured, raped, and stuffed in a trash can, where she'd slowly suffocated. Kirsten sighed, summarizing the experience as, "Sad, really depressing, gonna F you up in the mind." At this, Molly shot Kirsten a lawyerly look, as if questioning the wisdom of using the F-word in a Vanity Fair article. "I'm not a professional lady. I'll say whatever I want," Kirsten joked back. "You're a grown-up, and I'm..." She trailed off, seeming to realize then and there that she'd chosen the same career path as her murdered babysitter. I don't know that any woman has made it to being an adult without having some sort of traumatic experience, Kirsten concluded. I literally don't think it exists. The next day, presentation started at noon, but by 9 a.m., the World Center Marriott Convention Center was already packed. While some collected prizes from mock evidence lockers in the Oxygen TV lounge, mine an unflattering bucket hat in bumblebee colors, others queued to sit in massage chairs set before TVs playing Cold Justice, a true crime show about cold cases starring veteran prosecutor Kelly Siegler. Prosecuting Evil with Kelly Siegler dropped a month after CrimeCon. Siegler has spoken openly about witnessing domestic violence throughout her childhood. When she was a kid, her then stepdad beat her mother. Yet it was Siegler's mom who found herself on the receiving end of police lectures. If you would learn how to shut your mouth, the cop said, you wouldn't get in trouble. Young Siegler had seethed. You're telling her that? Go arrest him. Go do something. But they didn't. And the injustice of that was one factor that later propelled Siegler into law school, followed by a successful career as a prosecutor. In a court, she won 19 out of 20 death penalty cases, earning Siegler the nickname Giant Killer. In some cases, in special cases, not all the time and not that often, but sometimes, Siegler said of the death penalty, oh, it's justice. Later that day, a massive audience filled the main ballroom for a motivational talk by Kathy Kleiner Rubin, who recently published a memoir about triumphing over lupus, breast cancer, and one of the most infamous serial killers in history, A Light in the Dark, surviving more than Ted Bundy, co-written with Emily LeBeau Lucchese. And it's very good. 45 years earlier, when Kleiner was just 20 years old, the serial killer had brained her with an oak log, the same wood species used to make the electric chair in which Bundy later burned. Inspirational music and videography hyped Kleiner's entrance. Coldplay's Viva La Vida blared over the speaker system as a screen above the stage beamed the words, "Are you ready for the most emotional crime con yet?" And with that, Kleiner, all 4 feet 11 inches of her, stepped on stage. She waited out the deafening applause before launching into it. This is my story. After escaping through the ceiling duct of a Colorado jail in 1977, Bundy crossed state lines and crept onto the Florida State University campus, slipping through the back door of the Chi Omega house, to beat and strangle to death 2 sorority sisters. He raped one of them once she stopped breathing. Next, he entered 19-year-old Kleiner's bedroom. Kleiner, then an aspiring interior decorator, lay sleeping under a tree-patterned comforter, which she'd selected to match the bedroom's green carpeting. She woke to a silhouette looming over her. Suddenly, she was in searing pain, her tongue half-severed, jaw shattered, one cheek torn open. But before Bundy could kill her, car headlights swept across the bedroom window, prompting him to flee. In the ensuing melee of ambulance sirens and Bundy's criminal trial, young Kleiner found herself fixated on that precious blood-soaked bedspread, feeling sad that it was ruined. 45 years later, Kleiner's jaw still aches. I can't eat corn. She manages the pain with hot packs and cold packs, and every few years she endures yet another surgery. But what really helps, Kleiner says, is CrimeCon. I never had a therapist or anything, so just talking it out has been my therapy. She describes the convention as a kind of wellness retreat for survivors, saying she'd met so many attendees in so many different stages of trauma. Kleiner wanted them to know that women can get through more than they think, even though it's painful, and they might still be living through it, so it's not just a past crime, it's a current crime. Of her own scars, courtesy of Bundy, Kleiner said, it's kind of, you know, melting into who I am. Kleiner's sentiment would later be echoed by renowned serial killer expert Catherine Ramsland, Ph.D., a prolific author of 71 and counting books, who also happens to have once been Kohlberger's criminology professor. When asked during her CrimeCon presentation, Violent Minds, whether, looking back at her life, any experiences stood out as having seeded an early interest in crime, Ramsland laughed in surprise. Nobody had ever asked her that before. "Well," she said, "when I was a kid, there was a serial killer operating in my hometown, and friends of my brother's found the first body. The crowd oohed and aahed, so I would have to say that probably established it. There were other ordeals, too, it turned out, like a great-grandfather who tried to poison the whole family, and a grandmother who was murdered. So I have lots of things," Ramsland realized. After the presentation, she would elaborate to News Nation, "There's certainly violence in the background that has trickled down to me." As a scholar, Ramsland approaches true crime through a clinical lens, distinguishing her interest in the genre from its entertainment value. Like many of the women at CrimeCon, whose long list of safety precautions had partly been gleaned, they said, from crime stories, carrying mace, walking in groups, calling a friend to say where you're going, the subtext being that if you're abducted, people will know sooner, raising the statistical likelihood of finding you, or at least your corpse. Ramlin's conclusions on personal safety underscores the universal danger of being female. "When I walk past a male on the street, I will always watch over my shoulder. Always," Ramsland said to me in a follow-up interview, explaining that if somebody were to roll down their window and ask for directions, she would never approach the car. "Because I've known some of the strategies that offenders use to grab vulnerable people, which is not to say they could never get one over on me. Of course they could," she added. Still, Ramsland said she did what she could to avoid being killed by men like those she studied. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.